Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Jonathan Balcom, believes we need to rethink our relationship with fish. He has pored over a vast amount of scientific research and evidence to reshape our understanding of how fish perceive, feel, and experience the world. In his new book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins, Jonathan Balcom aims to give fish a voice in a way he says has not been done before. And why is that? Well, humans kill and eat trillions of fish every year. That's trillions with a T. According to Jonathan, fish are the most exploited vertebrate animals, and he argues for a paradigm shift in how we think about and treat fish. In his new book, he writes, quote, "In those flat, glassy eyes, we struggle to see anything more than a vacant stare. We hear no screams and see no tears when their mouths are impaled and their bodies pulled from the water. Their unblinking eyes amplify the illusion that they feel nothing. With a deficit of stimuli that normally trigger our sympathy, we are numb to the fish's plight," end quote. But fish are very diverse and complex creatures. They communicate, they use tools, they plan, yes, they do feel pain, and they conduct elaborate courtship rituals. Jonathan Balcom is director of animal sentience at the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy and the author of 4 books, including Second Nature and Pleasure Kingdom. He has 3 biology degrees, including a PhD in ethology from the University of Tennessee, where he studied communication in bats. Jonathan has published over 50 scientific papers on animal behavior and animal protection, and his latest book is What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. And Jonathan joins us today from the studio of WXEL in Boynton Beach, Florida. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. As someone who loves to snorkel and loves fish, I really appreciate this book. It was really fun to read. You wrote about fish that I've never heard of. I mean, in addition to rainbow trout, piranhas, elephant fishes, some of these fish I've never heard of. Why did you decide to give the fish a voice in this way?
Well, I can assure you at the time I started working on this book 4.5 years ago, I'd never heard of a lot of these fish species either. A couple of main reasons I wanted to write this book. First of all, as you intimated in your introduction, there's a lot of great science on fish behavior, their social lives, their sex lives, how they think and feel. But most of it is buried away in scholarly journals that most lay readers never see. So I wanted to make that information accessible to non-scientists. The second reason was also going back to your introduction that we have had a troubled relationship with this group of vertebrates. So we do kill huge numbers of them, and we have this sort of bias where we think that there's not much going on between those glassy eyes, when in fact, as the science shows, there's a great deal going on.
And so let's look at the numbers. One author, Allison Mood, has estimated, based on analysis from the Food and Agriculture Organization, that fisheries capture fish killed every year by humans is between 1 and 2.7 trillion. And this is every year, 1 and 2.7 trillion. Can you talk about that?
Sure. It's easy to forget that every one of those individual fishes is a unique individual with a personality and a unique life. And I take pains to clarify that in the book, and the science supports that. I mean, fishes recognize each other as individuals. They even recognize our faces, according to a recent study. So we need to look at them in a new way, and the science supports that. And so the fact that we kill a lot of them doesn't in any way reduce the validity that each is a unique individual.
And talk a little bit about the science. What has led to the increase in our knowledge about fish and their environments?
I think one of the key things is the advance in technology. We now have the technology to spend hours underwater watching them in their own realms and filming them with equipment that we now have. And that technology didn't exist a century ago. So it's only in the last few decades that we've had the ability to study them in their natural habitats in a way that we couldn't before.
And so you came up with so much amazing information about fish, and I took so many notes in your book, and I cannot pick just one story because so many stand out. But the one that I've been sharing with some friends is about the male deep-sea anglerfish. Tell us a little bit about these anglerfish.
It has to be one of the most bizarre sexual relationships in all of nature. Anglerfishes, the deep-sea ones, live in the largest habitat on Earth. That's the abyss, the area of the oceans that is so deep that light doesn't penetrate. So it's a 24/7 dark, quite cold habitat. And despite its huge, well, because of its huge volume, perhaps, individual members of different anglerfish species, and there's probably over 160 down there that we know of so far, they're spaced pretty few and far between. It's been estimated that a single female anglerfish is sort of like trying, for a male trying to find her, it's like finding a football in a football stadium in that kind of volume. That's the kind of volume of water you have with only one female in that whole area. So perhaps not surprisingly, males have evolved very good sense of smell. And I think quite good vision as well. Why vision in a dark environment? Well, because almost all anglerfishes, in fact, I believe all of them, produce their own light through a symbiosis with bacteria. That's pretty fascinating in itself. Hmm. But back to the sex part of things. What happens is that males, when they do find a female of the right species, and that's really important, you make the right identification, they literally latch on, and they latch on for life. They bite into her body. It can be any part of her body, pretty much. They're not too picky about that. And then they stay. They become fused. Their mouths become fused to her body, and eventually they absorb their way in, and they become sort of like a little appendage, and they inseminate her through the bloodstream. And some females have been found with three or more males latched onto them in this sort of permanent state. So it's the term that scientists use is sexual parasitism. It's something that some feminists may delight in or may cringe at. I don't know. But in any event, who knows what the female thinks of this? But given that reproduction is important for her as well, maybe she celebrates the fact, hey, I've got three males latched onto me.
And I didn't have to do anything to find them. Yeah, that was one story that really stood out for me. The other one, when you're looking at and talking about smell, a shark's sense of smell is 10,000 times better than ours. That is amazing.
And probably by volume, one 10,000th as good as some eels. So sharks, fabulous smellers, but some eels are even better. So I do write about the acute perceptual abilities that these animals have, and they have very keen senses of smell and hearing. Water is a great transmitter of sounds, and though we don't hear most of their sounds because we're evolved to hear sounds in air, and they're not evolved to produce them in air, if you go underwater and use hydrophones, you can actually pick up all kinds of a real cacophony of different sounds, particularly on reefs. But they also have some senses that we don't have, such as the lateral line, a row of sensitized scales that are very sensitive to changes in water pressure and movement, which is very useful for avoiding bumping into things in the dark, for instance, and sensing where your shoal mates are at any one time. Fishes also have evolved, some of them, a very acute electrical sense. Sharks can detect a little animal hiding under the sand by its heartbeat. The electrical pulse is given off by its heartbeat. So unfortunate for that creature giving itself away without meaning to. And some fishes actually produce their own electrical signals deliberately, and they use them as communication tools. So each individual has his or her own EOD, which is to say electrical organ discharge, that is at a certain frequency of pulses, and they can communicate themselves with each other using those EODs.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about pressure sensors. I've always wondered about the large schools of fish. You write that they can change directions seemingly as one, as if there were some internal knowledge of the decision-making of all the others. It isn't clear who starts it or if the chain reaction starts with whoever happens to make the first move. But if you've ever been underwater, it's an amazing thing to watch.
And a very beautiful one to watch, too. I was diving snorkeling in Puerto Rico last year, and I suddenly found myself in the middle of a very large school of, I think it was a species of herring, and they were all swimming in the same direction, and I swam along with them for a while, and it was this eerie sensation of I was moving, but I felt like I was stationary because they were always all going the same speed, and such was their numbers and density that it was essentially my entire visual field was these fishes. It was a really beautiful sight. But when you do see them change direction almost as one, it does give you the impression there's almost some perceptual ability that we don't even know. But it turns out careful studies of this type of behavior, as with birds who also can change direction as if it's by one, they actually are minute delays. They are actually responding and reacting to others in the school. So it's not just completely seamless. It just appears to be that way to us.
All right, so I picked out a few of my favorites, and there are so many more. But what were some of yours when you did your research? What really grabbed your attention?
Oh, so many things. I think, you know, people are often curious about how animals think. Here's one example, observational learning by a fish. And in this case, it was archerfishes, which are renowned for shooting water out of their mouths. They have specially shaped mouths, and they can shoot a jet of water and actually pick off flying insects at some distance. They can shoot water up to 10 feet. And they become remarkably proficient at aiming ahead of the target according to its speed and direction. And it turns out that young, naive archerfishes, they suck at it. They can't hit even a target moving at 0.5 inches per second, so they have no skill. But by just simply allowing them to watch experienced adults perform their targeting and shooting at targets, the young, naive ones learn from that. So you give them the opportunity for the first time to shoot at their own target since they've seen all these others doing it accurately. They actually have become quite proficient just by watching. So that's called observational learning, and it's considered a pretty impressive cognitive skill that they have. I could talk about tool use, planning, memory, problem solving, innovation.
There's so much.
You just let me know what you want.
Let's talk about visual capacity, because I also learned about humans in this part of your book. You write that we humans are trichromatic creatures, which means that we possess three types of cone cells in our eyes, and our color spectrum is more limited. Having four types of cone cells, fish's eyes provide four independent channels for conveying color information. Some fishes also see light in the near ultraviolet spectrum, where light's electromagnetic wavelengths are shorter than what we can see in the so-called visible spectrum. And this helps explain why about 100 known species from 22 families of reef fishes reflect large amounts of UV light from their skin. So tell us about
one
that.
Of those. Yeah, one of the UV-sensitive species is called the Ambon damselfish, and it turns out that they sort of have a yellowish color, which actually blends in quite well on the reef. So they're quite well camouflaged, but it turns out that they have their own facial signatures. It's almost like a fingerprint, only it's on the face. It's a bunch of dots that don't show up under normal light, but under UV light they jump out like a fingerprint. It looks a lot like a fingerprint, and they use that to identify each other as individuals, so they can recognize each other and communicate with each other through the UV spectrum, while their predators, unable to see that spectrum, are not compromising their camouflage to predators nearby. So it's a handy way of us covertly recognizing and communicating with each other without being spotted by your enemies.
You also found that studies of goldfishes and bamboo sharks show that they too respond to visual illusions. You can train goldfishes to discriminate black triangles from black squares on a white background.
Yeah, and listeners may be curious to know how you do train a fish, and how do you get a fish to tell you something, a preference, or to choose one of two stimuli. They learn just as other animals do by being rewarded for making a particular choice. So, for instance, in a study of red-tailed splitfins, it's a small freshwater fish, they were trained to choose the larger of two circles, and they chose that by, I think, they pushed their nose against whichever circle was larger, and they were rewarded if they picked the larger one, and they weren't rewarded if they picked the smaller one. So they very quickly learned to always go for the larger one. And then those fishes were presented with the Ebbinghaus illusion, which is two circles of the same size, but one circle is surrounded by larger circles and the other one is surrounded by smaller circles. So there's the illusion that the one surrounded by smaller circles is actually a bigger circle, when in fact it isn't. And when presented with that illusion, these splitfin fishes chose the circle surrounded by smaller circles, the one that has that looks like it's larger, even though it isn't. So it was, it's an illusion that humans fall for as well. So it's there's something poignant, I think, that a little fish will fall for the same visual illusion that we will. And there's other examples I present in the book of the same sort of phenomenon. So it suggests they can have beliefs that they see the world, at least in that regard, they perceive things as we do.
Today we're joined by Jonathan Balcom. He is author of What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. He believes it's time to rethink our relationship with fish. Humans kill between 1 and 2.7 trillion fishes every year. And yet there's so much new scientific information out there that shows that fish produce a symphony of sounds, they conduct elaborate courtship rituals, and yes, they do feel pain. So what questions or comments do you have for Jonathan? If you've ever had fish as pets, what did you notice about their behavior? When you eat fish, do you think much about their behavior, whether they smell, their senses, where they came from? What are your thoughts about that? And overall, what do you want to know about the lives of fish and our relationship to fish? How do you think it should change? The toll-free number is 86. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. Email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio. Jonathan, when you think about humans killing 1 and 2.7 trillion fishes every year, it's kind of overwhelming. And I keep going back between fish and fishes. But you have a note in your book talking about why you decided to use fishes. We don't often say fishes. Why did you decide to use that word?
Yeah, one of the central missions of this book is to present these creatures as individuals. And when we just reduce them all to fish, it kind of anonymizes them. It makes them all sort of the same. And that's just the last thing that's true. I mean, there's nothing true about that aside from their diversity of different species. Within a species, you have different individuals. They're all unique, and I write about that in the book. So so when I go hiking, I don't say I saw 5 mammal and 12 bird. I use the plural. So while the word fish is legitimately defined as can be a plural or singular, and the word fishes is also a correct word and usually scientifically refers to more than one species, I decided to write this book and refer to individuals, more than one individual, as fishes for that reason, to make them come across as individuals, which is what they are.
And so for full disclosure, I don't eat fish. I haven't eaten them in probably over 20 years. And I understand that you don't eat fish. How did you come to that decision?
It was a long time ago. I always had a soft spot for animals. I went fishing as a young boy, and I write about that those experiences early in the book. And I soon lost my enthusiasm when it came time for me to bait hooks with worms and to pull them out of fishes' faces. But it was some years after that before I came to a decision that I think I was always destined to come to, and that was to not eat animals. I've seen enough. I've worked in animal protection for 25 years, and I've seen enough slaughterhouses and transport trucks and factory farm situations and commercial fishing operations, for that matter, to know that the practices that typically go on in those operations are not practices that I want to fund with my dollars. And so it's an empowering way to vote with your wallet. You know, I don't have to support that. I don't have to buy those products, and so I choose other options. And by the way, bravo to you, Rose, for not eating fishes.
Thank you. Well, you also write, though, that the consumption of fish has grown dramatically in the world's two most populous nations. The average Chinese citizen eats 5 times more fish than in 1961, the average Indian more than 2 times. During that half century, the populations of these nations have also more than doubled. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization, the average human in 2009 was consuming 40 pounds of fish, nearly double what she consumed in the 1960s. And then here in the U.S., per capita fish consumption has remained fairly constant. What strikes you about the kind of fish that people eat, about the ways that fish are taken out of the ocean? What changes have we seen over the last couple of decades?
It's not an easy time to be a fish in the world, and that's borne out by a study published in 2013 by the World Wildlife Fund and another organization that estimates that we've seen a 50%, that's a half, loss of fishes and other marine life between 1970 and 2012. We fish them just constantly in huge numbers, and one illustration of that is fishing gear that's left and lost in the oceans every year to the tune of 680,000 tons per year. That's fishing nets, fishing lines, hooks, etc., that are left in the oceans. Bycatch is another measure of our rapacious relationship to the oceans. Bycatch refers to unwanted catches, it could be fishes, shellfish, shrimp, etc., who are brought up from the bottom or from the waters, but actually are not part of the commercial goal for that particular fishery. And so typically in the past, they have been discarded, tossed back into the water, usually either dead or dying, because they're brought up in these huge nets that are... It may contain, depending on the species, if it's a small enough species, can be a million in one net.
Wow.
And you think of the enormous weight of that being pulled up from the depths. Being pulled up from the depths alone is very damaging to life, because the change in pressure causes decompression, injuries, and death. But then you have the crushing of all that weight in the nets. And then if the animals survive onto the boat deck, then they're usually going to die of suffocation. Lack of oxygen to the body.
It's kind of hard to comprehend this, but as you write, bycatch is very common, and estimates of how many sea creatures we toss back as unwanted waste vary, but they're consistently eye-popping. You say try to visualize a pile of marine creatures weighing 200 million pounds, most of them dead, almost all doomed to die, and that is the daily bycatch we reap from the seas, 200 million pounds daily?
In my talk that I give on illustrated lectures and talks that I give on fishes, I usually include a picture that does appear in my book. It's a picture of a close-up of a net, a shrimp net that's being pulled up. The shrimp fishery is notorious for high levels of bycatch. And if you look at this net, the creatures that you can see through the mesh, there's not many shrimp in that picture. There's a lot of different species of fishes in there, eyes popping and mouths agape. And it's an illustration of just how non-targeted and how crude the methods are and non-selective. Trawling in particular, which is I think typically how shrimp are caught in the wild, involves essentially, it's kind of like bulldozing the rainforest, only it's analogous to that. It involves taking these big nets with heavy weights on the bottom, so they drag along the bottom, and they really mow down all the corals and other creatures that may be down there, and they just drag along, and then they catch whatever they can catch, including shrimp, but other species as well. So it's a very crude way of taking life from the oceans.
I'm looking at
that. The problem is, whenever people go, sorry to interrupt you, whenever people go and buy a product or order it in the restaurant, they need to be thinking about what they may be supporting, because if you buy these products, essentially you're telling the manufacturer, do it again, and you may not want to be telling them that.
Well, I was going to ask you that. The photo in your book of the shrimp and the bycatch, including many juvenile fishes, is on a semi-industrial shrimp dragger in Mozambique. What would you say? I mean, people eat a lot of fish. San Francisco is full of sushi places. If people want to cut back, if they want to maybe not eat as much fish, what would you say is a good place to start? Would you say shrimp?
No, I wouldn't really, just because the shrimp fishery is such a problematic one, both the farmed shrimp and the wild caught. So I would encourage people to try some of the alternatives that are out there now. If you want a fishy taste, you want a shrimp-like. I mean, I've ordered shrimp dishes at restaurants that never made contact with a crustacean. It's actually made by plant materials, and some of the technological advances in plant-based meats now are remarkable, and you can enjoy a similar taste that's delicious. delicious. I think when diners try stuff like this, I think it's maybe not the best decision to try to see, think to yourself, how well does it mimic what I used to eat? But rather, how palatable is it? How tasty? How chewy? Is it good? Does it taste good? Does it go well with the rice and the veggies or what have you? If you think that way, you're going to find that these are really delicious foods that are available now in supermarkets.
What I asked was if you're going to give up a certain fish, would you say shrimp would be at the top of your list?
I skirted your question, didn't I?
No, that's okay.
I wouldn't recommend going to shrimp because of the problems with the industry. I actually don't really want to recommend any particular fish. I mean, certainly you can do your homework and you can probably find that some fisheries are less harmful and destructive than others. If it's a farmed fish, I certainly wouldn't say that makes it any better. There's all sorts of problems with aquaculture, and I do briefly outline some of those problems, such as the confinement, the fact that these animals don't really have any freedom. There was a recent study done showing signs of severe depression in young salmon in fisheries, in aquaculture operations, who essentially just give up. They stop eating, they float to the surface, and measures of cortisol, a stress hormone in their bloodstream, shows that they're highly stressed. There's problems with parasites. There's problems with leakage of antibiotics and pesticides to try and combat the parasites into the surrounding waters if they're in sea pens, so that creates havoc with wild populations as well. The list goes on, but I certainly there's just as many problems with farmed fishes as there is with the wild caught.
Today we're joined by Jonathan Balcom. He's author of What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. What questions do you have about fish? If you eat fish, we'd love to hear from you. If your relationship with fish has changed over the years, give us a call or send us an email. This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
Take KLW wherever you and your smartphone go by downloading the NPR One app. It shuffles the latest stories and shows from KLW along with other NPR programs and podcasts. Find the NPR One in your phone's app store, and you can always find our signal streaming live at KALW.org. Today's Your Call is a rebroadcast from a previously broadcast show. We're not taking calls now. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Jonathan Balcom. He believes that it is time to rethink our relationship with fish. Humans kill between 1 and 2.7 trillion fishes every year. And there's so much new research out there about fish and their advanced modes of sensory perception, the fact that they can produce a symphony of sounds, they conduct elaborate courtship rituals, and yes, they feel pain. Jonathan writes about this in his new book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. radio. And let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yeah, this is can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Good. It's a remark or a comment, and I find that, in an illustration, I find that fish are smart and curious and friendly. And my illustration is I went to the Academy of Sciences here in San Francisco, and I looked at their I observed their tank. It's a big tank, floor to ceiling, with a current, with a turbulence going through it. They had the fish that live along the California coast, and I just took my time, and I sat and looked at the tank. I sat on the floor and looked at the tank, and after about 10 minutes, there were several fish that came and floated at me and backpedaled so they could stay right with me. Mm-hmm. And looked at me through the glass. So I wasn't in the tank with them. I wasn't in the water with them, but they were looking at me. And then they would just stay there, and it was all one species. It was a yellow perch-looking fish. And I thought, out of all those, and there were at least 15 species in the tank, but this one species, there were 10 individuals that came over and just floated and looked at me. And I thought that was remarkable, and I felt like I'd made a few pals that day. And I got to go back and see them again. I hope they recognize me. I hope they come over quicker next time. And that's my remark.
All right. Thank you, David. That's a great story. Jonathan, you have so many stories like that in your book. Which one stands out for you?
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, David. I did solicit stories from people and got a number of really nice ones, credible. I only included ones that I thought were credible. And time and again, people who take time and watch fishes in tanks and where have you, have those kinds of experiences where you see the fish responding to you and following you and recognizing you. And in fact, a recent study of those archer fishes we were talking about earlier found that they very clearly recognize human faces. So not only do fishes recognize each other in their schools and shoals as individuals, but they also can recognize us by our faces. David also mentioned fishes being friendly. It made me think of the virtuous behavior that we sometimes see in fishes. A recent study of rabbit fishes, sadly this was published after my book came out, so it didn't make it into my book. There's new stuff coming out all the time. Found that they do what's called cooperative vigilance. So they forage in pairs, and they forage by poking around in the reef. Well, if you're poking around in the reef, you're not really you're a bit distracted from some hungry grouper who might be coming along interested in making a snack out of you. So what happens is the other one in the pair plays lookout and swims with the head pointing upwards, looking around to see if anyone's coming. And then when the first one has had a nice little feed, then they switch off, and the one who is watching becomes the feeder, and the one who is feeding becomes the lookout. So it's a nice bit of virtuous behavior in a fish. And I include stories of loving behavior, fishes who love to be touched, and there's some good biological basis for that relating to cleaner stations. For instance, one discus fish named Jasper lived with his human guardian for about 9 years, and when she'd come home from work, Jasper would swim up to the glass, and they would play a little game of chase back and forth in the aquarium, swimming back and forth and running back and forth. And then after that, the woman, Karen, would cup her hands in the water, and Jasper would swim onto his side and swim into her hands and allow her to caress him. And for any listeners who may think I'm making this up, you can actually nowadays go onto YouTube and you can watch any number of videos of fishes who will swim up to people, trusted humans, to be picked up, even removed from the water for a while, and to return into the hand to get strokes and caresses.
You have a great story by the author Kathy Unruh. She wrote to you about a Bahamian grouper she calls Larry. Whenever Kathy and other divers descended to his reef, Larry would swim over to be petted. According to Kathy, Larry seems to enjoy making eye contact and checking out the diver's bubbles. He even rolls side to side to be petted properly, as a dog or a pig will do.
Yeah, these are long-lived fishes with good brains and social behavior, and not surprising, perhaps, that they will form alliances and friendships with other humans. These same kinds of fishes also form alliances with other species. Groupers will have been discovered in the Red Sea doing head shakes and body shimmies to signal to moray eels that, hey, I'm hungry, I want to go foraging, will you come with me? And if the moray's in the mood, then they both swim off over the reef. They look a little bit like a couple of characters out of a Disney film. And the way it works is, if they target a fish and the fish swims into the reef, well, the moray is like the ferret of the sea. The long, slender body goes in after it, and if the fish is caught, well, the moray's happy, and if the fish escapes into the open water, you know who's waiting out there. It's the big fat grouper. So, and studies show that they have a much higher success rate per capita when they hunt cooperatively than if they hunt individually.
What do we know about fish living in an aquarium by him or herself? Because you report that in parts of Europe, it is now unlawful to keep a goldfish, a naturally social animal who can live for decades, alone in a barren fish bowl.
Yeah, there's actually been a couple of laws passed in Europe that I'm aware of. In the city of Rome some years ago, the Netherlands has also passed some fish welfare laws. You consider a goldfish is a social creature who can live over 40 years. And if you consider all of that, and also the fact that their natural habitats are quite rich with vegetation and rocks and dimmer light and places to hide, it's a pretty awful thing to put one in a barren bowl in the bright light, and just essentially you're at the beck and call of what the human decides when they feed you, where they put you. So I think we need to be sensitive about the living environments if we're going to have fishes in captivity, which I don't particularly recommend. The aquarium trade is very problematic in itself. But if you are having them captive, then look them up and find out what their natural living environments are like, and do your darndest to mimic that as best you can. And if you can't mimic it, then don't have the fish. I mean, consider the royal blue tang, the character Dory in the new Disney Pixar film Finding Dory. I just read recently about them. Their minimum depth is 2 meters, and they can be comfortable up to 20 meters deep, and so they're happy to live at depths. There's not many aquariums out there that are going to be giving them that kind of depth of water alone. So just a simple consideration like that is very hard to meet in captivity, which is one of the reasons why, to its credit, Disney has a campaign. Humane Society International and some other groups are trying to draw attention to, don't find Dory. Don't get these fishes at aquarium shops. When you do that, you're supporting the methods that are used to catch these fishes in the wild and ship them around the world, where mortality rates are very high and deaths happen on the reef.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because I took my niece to see Finding Dory, and it's such a sweet movie, like they all are. Mm. But I was hoping that at the end of the film, they would say, "Leave Dory in the ocean."
Yeah, that would have been nice. So this campaign maybe needs to be ramped up further. There is a campaign going on, but often people, when they see these creatures in the films, it's like Dalmatians. There was a real run on Dalmatians after 101 Dalmatians came out in the animated version, and there was a real run on clownfish when Finding Nemo came out, and clownfish populations were decimated in the wild. And most people aren't aware of this, but that's what can happen behind the scenes,
right,
literally and metaphorically.
Before we get back to calls, I noticed that a lot of the studies, at least they seemed very torturous for the fishes being studied. I mean, we want the information, but at what cost? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I'm often asked that, especially when I speak to audiences. As somebody who's very clearly tries to be animal friendly myself, I am citing studies that are not always animal friendly. My answer to that is that I don't really have any control over what's being done, at least in the past. I hope that I may influence some future stuff, but given that the information's there, if it helps the fishes to bring that information to light, then I'm going to do that. And so, yeah, a number of studies in my book, including studies demonstrating pain in fishes, which are studies done by very clever, innovative scientists, but that nevertheless cause some pain and suffering for their subjects. I do describe those studies because I think it's important that people be aware that they've been done, and to be aware of the convincing results.
And is there a better way to conduct these studies, a way that would not exploit or abuse the fish or cause pain?
Well, I've written a couple of books about animal pleasure, and I do like to point out that so often ways to motivate animals in studies are depriving them of food and that sort of thing. And I think a better way is to offer them positive experiences. And I mentioned some earlier studies that do that. You can probe into animals' preferences by giving them a reward for one thing, and just denying them the reward in other cases. So while certainly it's challenging, and some, depending on what you're studying, it's challenging to come up with quote-unquote humane ways to perform those studies, scientists are incredibly innovative and creative, and I just so admire some of the methods they come up with to delve into the inner experiences of other beings, that I'm very confident that we can always come up with other ways. By the way, I'm associate editor of a new journal called Animal Sentience. It's a open access online journal. Anyone can read the contents at any time. And one of the principles of this journal that we have is that we not publish studies that are deliberately harmful to the subjects. So that's a way that we can encourage and motivate scientists to be innovative in positive ways.
Jonathan Balcom is author of the book What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. And Jonathan believes that we need to rethink our relationship with fish. He is director of animal sentience at the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy and the author of 4 books. And we have an email from Tim who says, thanks for this fascinating fish show. As you may know, there's an excellent restaurant in San Francisco with a few locations called Enjoy Vegetarian. They have a number of veggie fish options, including shrimp, shark fin, cuttlefish, sea slug, and abalone. My favorite by far is the eggplant with veggie sea bass. Wow, Tim, I can't believe I haven't heard of these. I'll check them out. There's also a vegan sushi place in San Francisco called Shizen, so you can enjoy sushi without taking our friends out of the ocean. Thank you for that email, Tim. And let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. This is more of a comment than anything. It doesn't have to do directly with fish, but I've noticed that people use coral and other deep sea things as decorations now. It's a sort of an interior design trend. And I was at a local flea market relatively recently where I saw a great number of pieces of coral being sold, and I would imagine that has an adverse effect on the fish population, and I know that coral reefs are in serious trouble, and this doesn't help when these things become a commodity. I wondered what the speaker thought about that.
Thank you, Chris. Jonathan?
Chris, thanks for the comment on that. Yeah, I mean, corals are in trouble as oceans are warming and acid levels, ocean acidification is a major problem we're seeing around the world. Coral bleaching is starting to happen where some of the minerals that corals normally would have are lacking, and the corals are just not thriving the way they used to, and they turn white. So if people are actually harvesting corals for decorations, then obviously that's just another level of exploitation. I don't know the specifics about the procurement of corals for household decorations, but it sounds like something that some attention needs to be drawn to.
And can you talk a little bit more about how all of this is affecting fish? You write about pollution, for example, climate change, how it's affecting the lives of fish and their habitats.
The richest diversity of fishes that we find in the oceans in one place are on reefs, and reefs are are driven by coral, the presence of corals, and these corals grow for hundreds, sometimes thousands of years, and they provide homes and food and the basis of the basics of the food chain for a great number of diverse number of species. It would be terribly sad if we lost these. We have to also consider that it's in our own interest, not just aesthetically, to protect ocean habitats. Consider that the oceans produce more than half of all the oxygen on Earth, and that's obviously something we rely on to breathe. And so if we harm the oceans, we are ultimately harming ourselves.
All right. Well, thank you for the question, Chris. Let's go next to Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Jonathan, and hello, Rose. The fossil fuel industry, the coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear power plants that generate a lot of our electricity, kill a tremendous amount of fish. For example, the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant sucks in 2.5 billion, with a B, gallons of seawater a day. An estimated 1.5 billion fish eggs, marine larvae, a year are swept along for the ride and churned, cooked, and killed. And over the 30-year operation and lifetime, approximately 45 billion fish eggs and marine larvae have died, and they're giving another 9-year increase in life, so that'll add up to about 58 billion deaths. And I believe that we should move to renewable energy, because solar panels, once manufactured and installed, use no water to generate electricity over their 20-year lifetime.
All right. Thank you for the call, Harvey. Let's go next to Jeremy in San Francisco. Hi, Jeremy. Welcome to the show. Hello, Jeremy. Did we lose Jeremy? He wanted to know if you're familiar with arguments around the early 1900s questioning the intelligence of animals, saying they're not intelligent but act on instinct.
The first half of the 20th century was a time of closed-minded thinking towards animals. It was sort of considered taboo to ask questions about what animals may be thinking and feeling. And I'm happy to report that that's changed markedly in the last 50 years, starting with some books by an American biologist named Donald Griffin. He started to write books in the 1970s about the question of animal awareness, animal thinking, animal minds. And now we see and Jane Goodall's emergence as a biologist with her chimpanzee studies around the same time or a little earlier, I think also were hugely influential in ushering in an era where it's no longer taboo to ask these questions, and scientists are asking really interesting questions, and it's legit. It's almost sexy to be asking questions about animal cognition, emotion. We actually published a paper in our journal recently, Animal Sentience, on the question of sentience in insects, the possibility that insects actually do feel, which is something that's been routinely denied in the past. So the time, it's a very exciting time to be an ethologist, one who studies animal behavior. And I'm glad to report that, a lot of the studies that I talk about in my book, What a Fish Knows, are reflective of this new open-mindedness in science.
Can you explain sentience? This is starting to get more attention these days, but a lot of people might be wondering what you mean by that.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I should have defined it earlier. Sentience is the capacity to feel, quite simply. There's the word sapience, which is the scientific, sciencey term for the ability to think, and then sentience is the ability to feel. And feeling has a number of manifestations. It can be the perceptual ability to feel, to sense things, to feel pain and pleasure. Those are sort of the basics. But also we can include emotions in that, those psychological feelings that we can have, pride and jealousy and anger and delight and surprise and all those sorts of things. And one of the reasons that science was quiet on these subjects for so long was because feelings are ultimately private, absolutely private. I mean, you know, Rose, you can tell me you're feeling happy, but I don't actually know how you're feeling. I don't even know what happiness feels like to you. You also could be lying. You could be just making it up. So we have to take it on faith that someone else is feeling it as they say they are. The fact that we have a discrete language to convey that is helpful, but animals have different ways of communicating how they're feeling, and we have to have a little bit of we have to be innovative to study it, and then we have to be a little bit of reading between the lines. But you can definitely, for instance, you can show that a surgeon fish is stressed by measuring their stress hormones, and then you can show that they will actually take action to relieve stress because they swam up to that little wand that could give them caresses on their back. And when they did that, their stress hormones went down markedly and very quickly, whereas fishes who were put with a wand that wasn't moving, that couldn't give them caresses, they ignored the wand and they didn't show any decline in stress. So that's an example of a study you can do to read and get a read on how an animal is feeling from the outside.
Email from Jennifer. She says, my daughter had an angel fish. It lived for 9 years. I felt so bad for the fish just being alone in the tank, especially after I read that fish have a longer memory than dogs. Is that right? Jennifer says, I tried to talk and pay attention to our fish, and I do not eat fish.
Well, certainly fishes have very good memories. There's a number of studies I cite in my book about different ways of memorizing, including a remarkable ability by a little intertidal zone fish called the frill fin goby, who can remember the topography of a intertidal zone where the rock pools are in just one trial by swimming over that area at high tide when the water is up and over that and that terrain. And that allows these little fishes to jump accurately from one tide pool to another without making a leap of faith and risking ending up stranded on the rocks.
Thank you for the email, Jennifer. Mary on our website says, thanks for this wonderful program. Fishes are such admirable but horrifically abused animals. Fishing harms so many animals in so many ways. All of the nutrients derived from fish and other animal products can be obtained from humanely and environmentally responsibly from plant sources, including the many marvelous vegan versions that are of virtually every type of seafood imaginable. Fish feel, and they deserve our respect. See fishfeel.org. That is a great organization and also a great Facebook page, and I know you mentioned it in your book, Jonathan. We have just a couple minutes left, and I just want to ask you, you know, again, to just be very honest about all of this. I'm a longtime vegan. You're a vegan. And I just wonder, the changes that we're seeing are incredible. I mean, The consumption of fish is really hard to wrap your head around, and as you write, it's just increasing. But at the same time, the Humane Society of the United States reports that more than 1,000 animal protection laws have been enacted in the United States since 2004. This is a number that rivals all of the animal protection laws enacted in American history prior to the year 2000. So you're seeing so much awareness raising. Can you kind of make sense of these two things that are happening? So much awareness raising, laws being passed, and yet the consumption of fish in many parts of the world is just on the rise. And other animals.
It's paradoxical that as our awareness and concern for animals is reaching an unprecedented pitch, our exploitation of them is also unprecedented. However, there are signs, as you indicate, that we are getting ready to turn the corner. The United States is consuming about 10% less meat, animal products in the diet over the last decade. So that's a pretty significant change that we're seeing here. And to the extent that the United States of America is a bellwether nation for the rest of the world, I think that may bode well. There's a lot that needs to change. And I think I'm hopeful that it will continue to happen. There's exciting changes in food technology. The Good Food Institute, formed by a friend of mine, Bruce Friedrich, very recently is plotting a lot of these changes and helping to motivate it through funding for new innovations in technology and food development. And it's extremely exciting. I mean, I have colleagues who sat down with the richest man in Asia a couple of years ago, and he essentially said, I'm going to have your product in all the supermarkets here. He gave them, I think, $26 million to help fund what they were doing right on the spot. I mean, Bill Gates has been talking about how important it is that these exciting food technology changes. So it's coming down the pike, but the public has to be made aware of this. We need to have I'm watching the Olympics right now, and I see pizza and meat ads on TV, and you don't see any broccoli ads, and it's frustrating. I have seen almond milk ads on there, though, and that's a new thing. So it's creeping into the new consciousness. It takes time. You know, large ships don't turn quickly. It takes a lot of sustained effort. I want to just give you one number that I learned from a co-guest on a radio show recently. A dead shark is worth about $108 for the fins and the meat. If that shark is allowed to live over the course of his or her life, that shark, through tourism and scuba diving and snorkeling and that sort of thing, on average is worth $1.9 million.
Wow.
So if we preserve animals and let them live, we really have a much better situation than if we take them and kill them.
Jonathan Balcom is author of What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. Jonathan, thanks for joining us, and thanks for giving a voice to the fish.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.